Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
In his most recent book, John Feinstein, the prolific and passionate chronicler of pro golf, examines the 2003 golf season. It was a year during which Tiger Woods was retooling his game, a year in which Woods did not win any of golf's majors. The four men who each did win one of them had never previously reached those heights, which gave John Feinstein his title, Moment of Glory, the Year Underdogs Ruled Golf. When I had the opportunity to speak with John Feinstein earlier this week, I began the conversation by asking him to remind me of how it had happened that Tiger Woods, the man who'd been winning majors for the previous 2 years as if they were his exclusive exhibitions, had left the field open to lesser mortals in 2003.
It really began on the practice tee at the 2002 British Open, which was at Muirfield in Scotland. Tiger had made the decision to fire his longtime swing coach, Butch Harmon. Butch Harmon saw it coming, anticipated it as far back as the U.S. Open, which Tiger had won at Bethpage Black on Long Island. But he could just tell Tiger wasn't happy. He wanted to fiddle with his swing, perhaps get a new swing coach. And sure enough, Tiger walked onto the tee, the practice tee, and said, "I'm fine this week, Butch. I'm okay." And that was the end of a 10-year relationship. And at that point, as you said, Tiger had won actually 7 of the previous 11 majors through the middle of 2002. And that started a string, when he fired Butch, of not winning any of the next 10 majors. And that opened the door for the four guys that I focus on in this book to win majors in 2003.
The first of the relatively unknown players to take advantage of the temporary decline of Tiger Woods was Mike Weir, who won the Masters in 2003. In one of the chapters about that triumph, you surprised me a little bit by writing, quote, "Cue the syrupy music." What inspired that?
Well, I mean, if you watch the Masters on television, it's full of syrupy music and syrupy phrasing and a tradition like no other. And they use all these silly terms. Fans become patrons, and the front nine is the first nine, and the rough is the first cut. If you can't make fun of the people at Augusta National, life just isn't worth living.
At the U.S. Open that year, Jim Furyk began his Sunday round 10 strokes ahead of Woods, and there were 24 players between those two, and yet you report that NBC's primary plot line that morning had Woods shooting a 60 or a 61 to win the tournament. How does a player like Furyk feel about that approach to televised golf?
I think that the players through the years, you know, Tiger Woods first came on tour in 1996, won his first Masters in 97 by 12 shots. Players have come to accept that. And Tommy Roy, the NBC producer of that U.S. Open, was very honest about it, that was his fantasy, that Tiger was going to be teeing off just as their telecast began. He was going to get on a birdie roll. He was going to shoot a record score and somehow get himself back into the tournament, and the ratings would soar. And, of course, that didn't happen. Tiger went the other way, and Furyk won going away. But I think just in the general golf world, the story that Mike Weir's caddy, Brennan Little, tells about that year's Masters, when Tiger was 11 shots back of Mike Weir after 36 holes and barely made the cut when they cut the field in half after 36 holes. And one of the other caddies walked over to him with Mike Weir leading Tiger Woods by 11 shots and shook his head and said, "Well, Brennan, I thought you had him there for a minute."
Actually, I think Phil Mickelson had the very best comment about what it meant to other players. Most of them were circumspect. Mr. Mickelson was not.
Yeah, when Phil was tied for the lead in 2004 at the Masters and Tiger was 9 shots back with 1 round to play, someone asked him, you know, "How's it feel to be tied for the lead and have Tiger be 9 shots back?" And as you said, most players will say, "I'm just playing the golf course. I'm not worried about anybody else, one player." And Phil just said, "It doesn't suck."
My favorite story among the tales of the winners of the four majors in 2003 concerns Ben Curtis at the British Open. On the night before the final round, his wife asked him what he thought would happen the next day, and Curtis, who had never even played in a major before, let alone won one, said, "I'm going to win." Ms. Curtis was, I gather, somewhat surprised.
Stunned, I think, is the word. And if you know Ben Curtis at all, you can see why she would be. He's a very quiet, unassuming Midwestern kid from Ohio who, as you said, had never played in a major. The night before that British Open began, when he introduced himself to Mike Weir and congratulated him on winning the Masters, Mike Weir said to him, "Oh, thanks so much. What brings you over here?" He didn't even know Ben Curtis was a golfer the day before the British Open began. So for him to turn around, and Ben Curtis wasn't leading. He was a couple shots out of the lead, and say to Candace, "I'm going to win." You can almost see her jaw dropping as they're getting into bed that night on the eve of the biggest day of what turned out to be the biggest day of both their lives.
To Mike Weir's credit, when he realized that Ben Curtis was in fact a fellow golfer on the PGA Tour, he apologized profusely for not recognizing
that. He did. He said it's funny because Mike tells that story, and he tells it in the context of how embarrassed he was. And of course, Ben's response was, "Well, why should he know me? I was playing on the Hooters Tour a year earlier, which isn't even AAA golf; it's AA golf, two levels below the PGA Tour." And Ben was just a rookie. He'd only played in 13 golf tournaments on the tour by then, so his attitude was, why should anybody know who I am?
After Ben Curtis finished his final round in that tournament, and of course there were still golfers on the course who might have caught him, according to what you've written, quote, "He really wasn't allowed contact with the outside world other than his caddy." Who makes rules like that, and why do multimillionaire golfers pay any attention to them?
Well, the rules of golf are very strict, and one of the rules of golf is that no one other than your caddy is allowed to advise you while a round of golf is going on. In other words, if you and I are out there watching someone play and we scream out, "That putt breaks to the left," when one of the guys is lining up a putt, technically we've broken the rules. Mm. And if he turns around and says thank you and or something like that, he could get in trouble for following advice from someone other than his caddy. Because there was a possibility of a playoff at that point, the round was technically still going on. So if someone said to Ben Curtis, you know, "The greens are a little drier now because it's late in the day if you have to go playoff," or anything along those lines, he could have gotten into some kind of trouble with the rules. So that's why they keep anybody who's in contention for a playoff away from the outside world.
So doesn't it seem to you, though, a little ridiculous that according to this rule, Ben Curtis's wife couldn't run up, give him a long hug rather than a short hug, and spend time with him while they waited for the rest of these guys to finish their rounds?
You're being logical, Bill.
Golf
is not a logical game. There is a reason why Greg Norman once famously said, "This is why golf is a four-letter word."
I don't want to leave Sean McKeel out of the quartet of winners. He won the PGA Championship in 2003. Part of your project in this book was to discuss the impact of winning a first major on each of these golfers. How has Sean McKeel fared since that autumn 7 years ago?
Of the four, he has by far struggled the most, particularly on the golf course. He's had injuries, shoulder surgery. He had a testosterone deficiency issue, which was diagnosed just as the PGA Tour was starting the drug test. And for a long time, the tour wouldn't allow him to take a doctor-prescribed testosterone pill to overcome that. So he was constantly feeling sapped of energy when he played golf. So he's really struggled. And in 2009, he lost his exemption as a fully exempt player to play in any tournament he wanted to on the PGA Tour. His five-year exemption for winning the PGA Championship was over, and he didn't make the top 125 on the money list at the end of 2009, so he actually had to go back to qualifying school as a major champion.
John, you also write about various players in Moment of Glory who almost won majors in 2003, guys who either weren't quite good enough or who suddenly inexplicably played a couple of holes badly when even playing moderately well would have landed them in the headlines. Which of those stories was the most difficult to research and write?
Oh, I think the most difficult was Len Matisse, someone I knew well, who lost the Masters in a playoff to Mike Weir. Played one of the great Sunday rounds in the history of the Masters, shot 65, but bogeyed the 18th hole after being 8 under par to finish 7 under par, obviously, on his final round, and has never gotten back to that level again. He injured himself in a skiing accident several months after that Masters, came back too quickly because he wanted to play in the 2004 Masters, and has never contended in a major and is completely off the tour right now, back playing on the Nationwide Tour, which is the AAA level of golf. And just a tough story because he was so close to having that imprimatur of Masters champion for the rest of his life and came up literally inches short.
All these guys, whether they won a major or almost won a major, seem to me they said to you, I'm just doing this so that I can get back to what it felt like that time when I won or when I almost won. It's almost like chasing that first high if you're a drug addict. I mean, maybe that's an inappropriate...
Or maybe your second high, Bill, because you've experienced the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
And beyond that, to prove that the one time wasn't a fluke. There are a lot of guys, very good players, Fred Couples, Davis Love, Tom Kite, Lanny Watkins, to mention a few, who've only won one major, who are considered great players. So there's no fluke involved, but these guys want to prove that it wasn't just one week in their lives, that they're better than that, that they could do it again.
The subtext of your book is, of course, the relative absence of Tiger Woods from the leaderboard at the majors during that year. He shot a total of 18 over par in the four events combined. He finished tied for 15th, tied for 20th, tied for 4th, and tied for 39th. Are the major titles won by these other guys sort of like the NBA championships won by teams other than the Chicago Bulls when Michael Jordan was trying to play baseball? Should they have asterisks by them?
No, because Tiger did in fact compete. He wasn't off playing minor league baseball. He was entered in those events. He played as hard and as well as he could, and on those weeks he wasn't good enough. So no, I don't think it would be at all fair to give these guys asterisks, and I don't think they feel any less major champions because Tiger Woods wasn't paired with them the last day than they would had he been.
How did the Mike Weirs and Ben Curtises of the world feel when, shortly after 2003, Tiger Woods returned to form?
Well, probably like everybody else, he's back. And I don't think anybody was shocked. I think it's much different than the circumstances now where Tiger has basically blown up his life and is trying to find some salvation through golf. Back then, he had only blown up his golf swing. And everybody knew that sooner or later, he was going to figure it out again and be the great player that he had once been. And as you said, in 2005, he started winning majors again and won six more until through the U.S. Open in 2008. He hasn't won since then, obviously.
The Pro Golf Tour currently seems, at least to me, to be in a state that somewhat resembles 2003, lacking a dominant Tiger Woods, who incidentally said on Wednesday that he wasn't seeking a swing coach, which is a nice hook for your book, as a matter of fact. But how long
Tiger
is this...
will do anything to help me out.
I'm sure of it. How long is this Tigerless state likely to last?
I don't think there's any way for any of us, including Tiger, to really know. He played very well at the Masters when he finished tied for fourth after a five-month layoff from competition, and then played very poorly in his next two tournaments. He's only played, going into the week at the Memorial, nine competitive rounds on the year, which means he will have played 13 going into the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. He dominated the last time the Open was at Pebble Beach. He won by 15 shots, which is unheard of in any kind of golf tournament, much less a major championship. So if he's going to find his game again, his magic touch, Pebble Beach and St. Andrews, which is where the British Open is going to be, where he's won twice, are places where you would expect him to find it if he's going to.
John Feinstein is the author of a great many books about golf and various other sports, most recently Moment of Glory, which is published by Little Brown. He joined me from the NPR studios in Washington. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks again. Always a pleasure.
My conversation with John Feinstein will be featured in this week's program. Then we'll move on to what's more significant in the world of sports and the world in general, namely the World Cup. Since the U.S. team will open their campaign in South Africa a week from Saturday against England, we felt a profile of the unfortunately doomed English side would be appropriate. But we'll not neglect the playoffs transpiring on our own shores. I'll be talking basketball with Bob Ryan, who has covered the Celtics since slightly after the invention of basketball, and Ted Green, who follows the Lakers for the L.A. Times. Bud Collins will join me from not-so-sunny France, where Roger Federer and Serena Williams have made sure that whoever wins the signature events there they won't be the favorites. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.